for every Coldplay, there's 10 other Coldplays that all got signed in the same year. You know, yeah, there's a lot of broken dreams in the business.
But I understand why people have terrible drug problems and alcohol problems, because a lot of the entertainment industry is finding out it's nothing like you thought it would be.
I was nowhere. You know, I'd lost my record deal, massively in debt, and no obvious signs that I would ever be able to recover that, you know, because the career looked to be pretty much finished.
I still felt the enormous pressure from the label or the whatever expectations, but I didn't worry about that too much, luckily. I didn't really let that in.
I was terribly ambitious, really, both in terms of getting on Top of the Pops, but also in terms of getting my vision to come true.
I spent 10 years of my life with no money. Trying to get a record deal was so I was my own boss and I could do what I want.
But at that time, I remember coming over here and it was the only thing I could see was miles and miles of Oasis posters. And we didn't really have that vibe at all.
There is no formula to having a hit record. It happens, and it's probably 60% luck, 30% talent, and 10% timing.
I think the idea is to remain yourself, but stay open to being influenced.
Because you're altering the DNA of everything you've been listening to, altering it, bringing it up to date, modifying it, and turning it into a kind of higher art form.
Hello and welcome to The Art of Longevity. I'm your host, Keith Joplin. Brett Anderson of Suede once said that all successful artists have navigated four career stages: the struggle, the stratospheric rise to the top, crash to the bottom, and the renaissance. On The Art of Longevity, we talk to artists who spent decades in the music industry and discover what the journey has been like for them and how have they experienced each of Brett's four stages. Along the way, there are some great stories of the ups and downs and the roundabouts of a career in music, insights for fans and aspiring musicians. This is The Art of Longevity. The Art of Longevity is presented with Bowers & Wilkins, the renowned British premium audio brand. Hello, this is episode 1 of season 5, in which I have a chat with Jonathan Higgs, the singer and one of the main writers in the English pop rock band Everything Everything. Everything Everything are known for being eclectic and bringing together lots of ideas, both musically and lyrically. They blend indie rock with contemporary R&B, pop, electronica. They've expanded their sound from the early days of being guitar-based to being much more about electronic pop with the use of programming, processing, and their songwriting approach is unconventional. It's been referred to as progressive or psychedelic. Paul Lester compared Everything Everything's music to a riot in a melody factory, which I really liked because they paid lots of attention to melody, blending all those ideas together in a way that's very disciplined, especially on the new album Raw Data Feel, which is my favorite album so far, 2022. And it's a very cohesive 14 tracks, end to end, all killer. I wanted to talk to Jonathan about the making of Raw Data Feel, which included some elements of artificial intelligence. But we also get into a conversation about what it means to measure success as a band in the music industry landscape of 2022 and to think about longevity when you're 6 albums and 15 years into a career. This is episode 1 of season 5 with Everything Everything. Welcome to The Art of Longevity.
Hello, sir.
How are you, Jonathan?
I'm good, very good.
This is the Monday after Glastonbury. I know you weren't there performing this year, but were you there or did you see any of it on the TV?
We were in Prague on Friday night and the gig itself was at like 1 a.m. So we were not really in the mood for watching Friday night. I did watch Saturday night, watched Paul McCartney. Didn't see anything last night because I was drunk. So, I mean, I may watch Kendrick back, but I'm not particularly bothered. There's also a certain element of jealousy, the fact that we weren't playing this year. So that does tint it a little bit.
Takes the edge off it. Yeah, I wasn't there either. I was at Rock in Rio. I was actually seeing A-ha and Duran Duran.
Well, that sounds like a good night as well.
It was a great night. And I did hear, for sure, I think a fair bit of the origins of everything in you know, yeah, across both sets. It was really cool from that perspective.
Yeah, that's fair. We do really like Duran Duran. A-ha, I've always felt like there's probably a good wealth of stuff to look into, but I just never have.
Yeah. No, there is a huge wealth of stuff. I'd start with Scoundrel Days. I think that would be up your street.
We covered Take On Me at Alex's wedding. We were the wedding band and we sang that. It was too high for me, so Alex had to sing it.
Yeah. He does get quite high, does Morton, yeah. John, I wanted to get you on because I'm a very recent fan, I have to say. I'm familiar with most of the catalogue, but Come Raw Day to Feel, it is my favourite album of 2022 so far.
Oh, wow. Thank you.
I absolutely love it. I love the ambition of it. And I think I read an interview with you after Fever Dream say you wanted to do something more ambitious, and you've definitely achieved it. I mean, it's absolutely great. So congratulations, first and foremost.
Thanks very much.
And it's 14 songs, which is long for an album these days. My theory is albums are getting shorter. But there's 14 killer tracks on this album. So let's talk about it for a bit. I know it involved a bit of AI and a bit of Kevin, and I'd like you to sort of get into that a little bit. But I was very relieved, first and foremost, that Kevin ended up contributing approximately 5%. That's what I read.
Yeah, that's true.
So was that less than you intended?
I didn't intend anything with this record. I think that's the best way to put it. We were suddenly, kind of by surprise, we were challenged to make another record that we didn't intend to make. We put out Reanimator in 2020 during the pandemic, and we thought we would be touring that. And, you know, maybe the dates would have to be pushed back or something like this. But effectively, that was the mode we were in, gearing up to play live. We were just waiting for the pandemic to die down, and it didn't die down. And it just kept going on, and we were like, well, what else can we do? We're a band that can't play. We have to make another record. It's all we can really do. But because vinyl takes a hell of a long time to make now, and we wanted to hit a specific part of the year for the release for various reasons, we had this very, very small 3-month window to write and record and finish. So from scratch to mastered another record. And we had no plans for it. We had no ideas necessarily ready to go. I hadn't been studying obscure scientific bollocks like I did for the previous record. It was something like, guys, you've got to make a record and you've got to make it now. So that was how it began. So no, I didn't intend the AI to feature at all. I didn't have that idea until huge amount of the way through it. So that was incorporating lyrics written by a machine into what I was singing. That was almost just a little experiment of mine that if it didn't work, I probably wasn't even going to tell the guys in the band about, let alone press. But it did work, and it was interesting, and it changed a lot of things about the record in terms of some of the themes were affected by it, and some of the reaction to the songs and the lyrics suddenly had this new coat of intrigue for people, because they didn't know if they were listening to something that was plucked from my soul or something that was plucked from a machine that had learnt the terms and conditions of LinkedIn.
Yeah.
So that for me was really cool, I thought.
Yeah, so in a literal sense, maybe the contribution of AI was small.
Yeah, you know, honestly, it was more the fact, like, as soon as I said for the first time to someone, some of these words are written by AI, that was actually as powerful as it was going to get, because that's all it takes. It doesn't really matter if you know what the lines are, and I don't tell anyone what the lines are. It doesn't really matter if you know how much AI is in there. In truth, it's not very much. It's the fact that you will already be attributing meaning and emotion to something that comes from a machine and you don't even know. And it throws everything into doubt, and it throws up so many new questions about where meaning even comes from in lyrics. And it's increasingly clear to me that really the meaning comes from the listener. It doesn't really come from the artist at all. Because I've had hundreds of people tell me their meanings for my words before, and they're all different, and then none of them are my meaning, and it doesn't matter. It's great.
Yeah, I think that's the beautiful thing about a song, right? Once you put it out there, everybody adapts it in their own way. So in that sense, you've used AI as in, I think they call it generative AI in music, which is using it for inspiration. That was the relief to me a little bit. You know, I do have this sense that someone up there in, you know, the high echelons of music tech land is plotting AI to do something more sinister than the way you've used it, which would put musicians out of a job. What's your experience of using it? I mean, do you think it's got the potential to do that?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I don't think I'm the first. I've never looked into it. I'm probably almost certainly not the first person to do this. And there are probably artists out there for which the music is generated, the lyrics are generated, the performance itself is simulated, and the image attached is generated. I bet that's already out there and doing really well. That will be its selling point, but I think that will happen increasingly so until people don't even bother to say, I'm listening to what's his face. And we all know that that person doesn't exist. It's just accepted. I think that's probably the next 5 years, 10 max. You already get models on Instagram that have millions of followers, and the model literally doesn't exist. It's a 3D avatar or whatever, which is more generative, which is becoming really powerful now. And no one cares. They just see a very, very beautiful model who looks kind of unlike anyone they've ever seen. And they look great in those clothes. And they click like, because that's what people like, you know? And, yeah. And if that happens to be a song and it makes you feel a certain way, then you know, emotions are real, whether you like it or not. It doesn't matter where they come from. Some people get it, you know, from a beautiful sunset, and some people get it from killing the boss in Super Mario.
Yeah. It's a true sort of principle of the metaverse, I guess. So if we talk about the longevity of everything, which I hope we will, you'll be competing alongside, you know, artificial intelligence artists and avatars and what have you in 10 years time, if competing is the right word.
Yeah, it's not competing. The thing about AI and generating art, there's this sensation that everyone gets, me included, when you come across the concept and you think, oh, so it's not really come from anywhere real. It's not going to be good, firstly, and then it's not going to mean anything, secondly. But really, a generative thing, certainly, like the lyrics thing I've used, it's just taken language written by some humans. I chose stuff that was purposely not poetic, like terms and conditions, and some poetry sources, and it's recombining them. That's actually all it's doing. And when I write a song, I'm taking words that someone created in the year 800, and I'm recombining my language to create a song. I'm literally doing the same thing the AI is doing, but I've got my emotions attached to it. But it's not like the words the AI use, someone made them up and they have meanings. It's just recombining them, and our brains are finding patterns in it and finding meanings in it. I don't think it isn't even that different to what I do. It's just I'm a human, really.
It's exactly that. I know it sounds weird. Well, it's really interesting to think of it that way, because I'd say what it is, that is the difference. You are human. Yeah. But I mean, you're saying essentially sometimes that line is so blurry, maybe it doesn't matter that much. Well, I mean,
does it really matter if I recombine 6,000 words into a sentence that makes sense, or if a machine does that based on all the sentences that it's been fed into, which come from humans, and all the words that were fed into it, which come from humans. And then a human listens to it and goes, that does that to me. Nothing really that alien is happening. Some human sources are being recombined, not by a human, that's the difference, and then reinterpreted by humans. It's just humans to humans.
All right, so if you want to keep Kevin's lyrics as the mystery, you're not going to give me your favorite Kevin lyric from the album, no. Then, I guess.
Well, I can give you one. I'll give you one I've been sharing, which is the title of the song, Software Greatman. That's an AI creation. I didn't come up with that.
Yeah. So, and it's a great closing song, by the way. It's good to know that AI can come up with a musical epic. The Art of Longevity is presented with Bowers & Wilkins, a premium British audio brand. Bowers & Wilkins loudspeakers are trusted by some of the world's leading recording studios, including Abbey Road. It's a pleasure to have Bowers & Wilkins supporting the show. So I'm really surprised the way you've described the making of the album, because it comes across as a very coherent piece of work, full of melody. So in a way that you're kind of saying it was thrown together, plus the sort of Kevin element, it's come together extremely well, I have to say.
Yeah, I think that the pressure on us actually made diamonds, as the saying goes. I think something to do with the coherence and the basically where everything sounds like one body is another byproduct of doing it in a short time, because that's the state of mind we were in. That's the kind of music we wanted to make. It wasn't spread over 6 months where, you know, I feel sad this day, I'm going to write this kind of song. It was just like, bam, 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 let's write party bangers because we feel like X, Y, or Z. And these are the kinds of sounds we're going to use because that's what we've got at our fingertips and we have to make it now. And I think that actually really does make a good album, to be honest. Loads of albums are made in that way. And I think overthinking stuff doesn't always result in the best stuff. Anyway, we've made our overthinking albums. This is a new approach. We're happy to be thrown out of our comfort zone. And you can't think too much about something when you've got these deadlines. You have to write songs and they've got to be as good as you can make them.
I guess, you know, the deadline is the creative constraint that you have. And it feels like that you've been getting better at the discipline of, you know, leaving stuff out, I guess, yeah, and getting on with it and finding the craft of the 3.5 minute pop song, because, you know, you do have a reputation for fitting a lot of ideas in. I like the description that Paul Lester said of Everything, Everything early on, I think, which is the riot in a melody factory. Mm-hmm. I like that because the melody is always there, but there is a lot of, you know, the ideas are clattering along. So as a group, as a band, how do you compose? Does the melody come out of the ideas, or do you have the melody in your head?
So me and Alex write, and the other guys don't write. And the usual way is that, in fact, in 99% of cases, it's harmony first and then melody. And in, say, 80% of cases, I'll be writing the melody, regardless of who started the song. That's kind of my primary role. So, yeah, harmony first. I mean, there are maybe two occasions where the melody came first. There's one, I wrote No Reptiles just literally walking down the street, and I kind of knew the harmony at the same time as I knew the melody. And it was one of those occasions where you're convinced that this is already a song. And when that happens, it either is a song or it's your best song. It's really, really weird. It's very, very rare. And you go, it's got to be something. This must be something. I know this is something. It's like, no, it's not. It's just pretty good. So yeah, that's usually the way. And the melodies, well, I guess my approach to the melody, people do ask me this a lot, like, why are your melodies like that? Or where do you get them from? And I know where do you get them from is quite an open question, but I think I always strive to have a surprising melody and a colorful one. And that means maybe putting leaps instead of runs sometimes, or not repeating for a long time. So you'll get a melody that goes all over the place and you think, oh, well, this isn't even a melody. And then once it repeats, you go, fuck, it is. It's a melody. And it's kind of glorious once you have not necessarily complex, but just a long one. There's some great songwriter, I can't remember who it is, I think it might be McCartney actually, who talks about that exact thing where a verse where the melody doesn't even repeat once is like a great melody. And I don't even know if I do that. I just think that I do that. If you actually listen to my songs back, I probably do repeat a lot. But yeah, I think I'm trying to surprise the listener and surprise myself with the color of a melody. So it's exuberant and it already has a lot of feeling in it before there are any words. Like Birdsong, you can attribute feeling to a Birdsong. Usually they're just saying, let's have sex, or it is the morning. But there's still a lot of energy in melody before lyrics. And I think that the more of that you can have, the more interesting and powerful it can be. I could be just saying la, 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 la. But if you say it with the right melody, you know what I'm feeling. I think that's really great.
No, totally. I mean, it's, you know, we were talking about Duran Duran earlier. I mean, they've always done well with the wordless chorus. And I hear what you're saying about the lift or the surprise. And I feel like there's a lot of that happens on this record. Feeling of a song like Bad Friday. You know, melody just sort of soars out of that song. So there's a little bit of a sort of dissonance somewhere in the song, and then the beauty comes out. So it feels a little bit like, tell me if I'm making this up as well, that your voice on this record is quite a finely honed instrument. It feels like you've learned to even sing slightly differently than on the previous albums. Or is that just because I'm hearing an album that I really love?
I think it's a few things going on there. One is that, I'm probably better. But I think I'm also probably, I don't really know. Here's the thing. I don't listen back to my takes when I've done them. And there's a guy we work with, Tom Fuller, and he was in charge of vocals. And he would tell me if I hadn't nailed it yet, et cetera, et cetera. And he would edit them and he would present them. He would produce them. So that can be as hands-on or hands-off as you like. Sometimes he would leave errors in. Sometimes he would meticulously edit so that it's perfect, like pure pop. And I said to him at the start, I want this to be presented as, you know, whatever you would do for the biggest pop act you've got. And he works with some big pop acts. I don't really want to sound like a, you know, emotion. You know, I'm not non-emotional, but I want it to be perfect. That's what I said to him. And he was like, okay. So I think he's done some editing, but I do think I'm quite good at singing as well. And it's really down to his choice of what, it's up to everyone's perception of what you think good, you know, a good performance is. Is there emotion in it versus is it technically proficient? And it's getting that blend right, I think. So I don't know is the honest answer, because I don't know what's completely real and what isn't. Yeah. I feel as though I sing like that every night. And then I listen back sometimes like, oh, I'm not as good as I thought I was. So I don't know.
Yeah, so maybe you're not the best judge. As a listener, that's the feel I get. And that the, you know, your voice is very much a vehicle for the songs. Keith here. Thanks for listening to The Art of Longevity. I hope you're enjoying the conversation so far. Please tell your friends, listen back to the other episodes. And don't forget to subscribe on whatever podcast platform you listen to. Back to the conversation. I've got a question from a kind of industry marketing point of view, I suppose, because with this show, I kind of come at it from a fan perspective, but also from an industry insider perspective. Now, I think you've made, if not a masterpiece, very close to it. So let's say, you know, your best work is still ahead of you and it's on the way. I mean, for me, as I said, it's just such a great album. So how do you make a record like that last in the marketplace or with the audience? Because it seems to me like albums just come and go so rapidly. They almost evaporate. And it doesn't matter how good they are or by, you know, how big an artist they are. 2-3 weeks and it's sort of gone in a puff of smoke. But I don't want this to happen with this record. It's got to live.
Yeah, I mean, I wish I knew the answer to that question. Maybe we're old is the first thing to say because we want that or because that's how we consume records. And I think to myself, do I give an album 2 or 3 weeks and move on? And I'm old-fashioned in that sense, and I listen to them loads and consider maybe 5 albums a year to be the ones that I listen to that year, even if I, in reality, listen to 80. I'll only really hold on to a few of them. There's nothing that I can do, nothing my band can do to make any bigger impact. Even someone like Harry Styles, it's sort of a flash in the pan. It really is. Maybe Adele would be an example of lasting, but that's because she makes so few of them. That's the other thing we talk about a lot is oversaturation. You know, we're already starting to have little conversations about what we're doing next. And the record only came out 3 weeks ago, as you say. It used to be it comes out and then you put out 5 singles. Now it's you put out 8 singles before it comes out and then it's gone in a week. I think getting to people at the right age is what makes albums last. My teenage albums are still the ones that I hold most dearly and the ones I think about when I think about great albums. I don't think about an album I heard when I was 28, really, unless it was really exceptional. So I guess getting the record to young people is paramount. That's all you can do if you want it to last, is get them while they're young. And we've been lucky in our career in lots of ways. And one of the big ways was getting into young people, I think. And for some reason, our records are quite appealing to children, actual children. And at the time, we just thought, oh, that's a bit weird. But now that a lot of them have grown up, now they're in their 20s, some of these eight-year-olds, they're dedicated as anything. And they, the music went into them at such a crucial time. It's really into them. You know, they're going to be with us for life. I think. And that's the only way I can think of to ensure longevity.
So when you're looking out to your audiences, you're seeing a young audience there.
It's always been a mixture, but yeah, I'm always surprised by how many young people we manage to retain and attract. I mean, we had the prog dads there on the first gig, and they've never left us either. And the majority of our listenership is roughly our age, but there's still a steady stream of young ones coming up, which is always really great to see.
Yeah. Also, I think young audiences, they want something that's got that little bit of weirdness to it, you know, hence Stranger Things, I guess. Hence a lot of pop that was performed over the weekend at Glastonbury. It's got an edge to it, which your music has. So that kind of makes sense. So in terms of how the album does last, vinyl, I think, is making a bit of a difference as well, because you've got that sense of investing again. And that's what happened with this record. You know, I just sort of, because music comes at you like a waterfall, it is just occasionally stopping and saying, right, okay, I'm going to pick this one, and I'm going to make this one, you know, the one that they'll play and become familiar with. And it's got that depth to it, which is fantastic. So anyway, I'd recommend everybody to, you know, play it start to finish. Just one last thing on it. When I do that, I've been hearing a musical sort of got that storytelling element to it. That might be one way of maybe making it last further.
Well, I mean, I don't really like musicals. I kind of like the idea of musicals, and whenever I actually encounter them, I'm like, oh, this is horrible. But I, at the same time, I love the idea of high concept albums, you know, with interlinking songs and narrative that goes across it, and it being really nerdy and really in depth, even if the reality, we never really do it because it actually isn't that good. And it makes for worse music. Maybe it's a better musical because it's got our songs in, but the album isn't as good as if it wasn't one, et cetera, et cetera. And this is the conversation I have with myself basically every time we make a record. And this is maybe the most concept-y record we've ever done. That, you know, there's Kevin as a character appears in, you know, four or five songs. And I've never done anything like that before. And there's a very clear attempt by me to link songs and have somebody who's in them all that isn't just me. So yeah, I'm very attracted to that idea, but I don't think we'll ever go all the way because I don't like musicals very much.
Yeah, that would be the challenge, is to make a good musical.
I think we could make a good musical, but it wouldn't be a good album, if you know what I mean. I don't know, I think we'd get lost in whatever the story was, you know, it just wouldn't be a good album, I don't think. It would become its own thing, which maybe I'll do one day, I don't know.
So where are you? You're kind of 15 years into your commercial career as Everything Everything, and Raw Data Feel is the sixth album. That makes you relatively young as a guest on this show, but do you think about longevity as a band? Do you talk about it, or do you feel like you've kind of crossed the Rubicon already and it's just a case of keeping going? Yeah.
We crossed it on our third record. I think that was the point where we sort of thought, okay, we can probably stop worrying about being in a band as a job. I think we've done the thing, whatever it is, essentially woken enough people to us that we can probably sustain. Probably, I don't know. It's still a, you know, it's a weird job and it's an unstable job. But we've always approached the band as a long-term thing and wanting it to be one of those bands that would rather leave a cult lasting legacy that people in 20 years refer to and influence new bands than a big fucking band that does one really good record and then everyone sort of goes, oh, that's so 2010, 2 years later. We just weren't part of a wave and we weren't very big. You know, at the time, we've had this steady sort of grind of cult, which I think is preferable. It's the kind of, it's the only, but at the end of the day, it's the only kind of band we can be. That's what we are. And that's the kind of career we've had. And it's one I'm very proud of.
Looking back over the albums, feels to me like your last three, maybe even four records have been building towards something that is this cohesive thing, that you found that everything sound, which, you know, there's so many references that you can compare the band with, but you've melded it into something uniquely you. I mean, if you go back over the earlier records, do you feel like there was a moment where you felt the fragility of being in a band?
Yeah, I mean, the whole first couple of records are sort of fraught with those kind of feelings. It's like, should we make this song more radio-friendly? It might be the only chance we ever get to be on the radio, things like that.
Yeah. And
you have no idea what's going to happen to you when you make your first record. It could just be nothing, or it could be everything. Most likely, it's going to be somewhere in between. We tried to put out as many different things as we could to show ourselves that we could, firstly, but secondly, because it opened up, say there's 12 tracks on Man Alive, there's 12 paths we could take from here. It's not like Definitely Maybe, where it's like, here's 11 songs that are, you know, similar, they're good, but, you know, I think we know what's going to happen next with that. With Man Alive, it was like, what the fuck is going on from track to track? And that is such a liberating thing. Your fans don't know what to do with it for a start, and you don't necessarily attract one big crowd. It's not like we're a metal band and we get the metal crowd. It's like we got the prog dads, we got the hip hop fans, we got teenage girls who like the pop side of us. We got such a massive, diverse set of fans, and we're still seeing that now. In when we look out at a crowd, it's wonderfully diverse because people like different things from us, and we still cater to them all, I hope. Every time we put a record out, people will be like, oh, I miss the busy drums of, you know, Ark. And so I wish that they played more odd time signatures like Fever Dream, you know, and I miss the heavy stuff they did at the start of To The Blade. And so we have all these things rushing around, and we're like, actually, no, this is a dance record now, or this is a... And I love... I can't remember what the question was. I'm just going on about my band now, basically. But it's really liberating having lots of different threads. And I don't think it's a lack of focus thing. I think it's it's how all bands should be. Yeah. It should be like, we can do this, so we're going to try and do it. You know?
Yeah, it feels like that discussion would happen every album, because still, even in this day and age, each album is such a huge step and it's such a big creative statement at the time. And they don't come along that often. You know, it's just every few years, a lot of work goes into it. The Art of Longevity is a team effort. The show is produced by the Song Sommelier, that's me, with Project Melody. It's audio engineered and edited by Audio Culture. Our amazing cover art is by the wonderful Nick Clark, and original music for the show is by Andrew James Johnson. But you were signed to a major label, right? So you had that experience from Ark, second album. So I think you made three albums on a major label. So what was that conversation like? Because, I mean, I'm just being a little bit predictable here in saying this, but I guess they saw commercial potential in the band and wanted you to kind of go down that route of making those melodious commercial singles.
Well, firstly, the first record was also on a major. It just went to great lengths to look like it was. So they signed us for Man Alive songs, you know, which are arguably our least, you know, pop songs, certainly some of them. But no, this idea that the major label wants you to do certain things is true, but I can honestly say we never got asked to do that at any point when we were on a major. We literally never did. We made the songs as pop as we wanted them to be. And some of them were very successful on things like radio. But that was all from us. They literally never stepped in. I wanted to call Get to Heaven, Give Me the Gun. And they said, maybe think of another title in case there's a fucking terrorist attack the week it comes out. And they were right about that.
Yeah.
And that's honestly the only thing I can think of that they said to us in all those years we were on Sony was that.
Yeah, I guess that was a lucky draw then for you, because it's good to it's good to hear it, but that tends to be, you know, not what we hear.
I know, and it's well documented that, you know, the, how much they can be twats, but there are something about the type of band we are, I think, just gave, I don't know, we always felt very respected by labels, and I think a lot of the time we would come at them with so many ideas that I think they were just happy for us to do what we were doing, because we were a very self-sufficient band. We would come up with, you know, a million ideas a song for a start, but then we would come up with all the videos and all the artwork and all the way to present ourselves. And this compared to, say, One Direction, where obviously everything has to be done for them, it was a very easy act to have. And I think it was quite nice for them to have us.
Yeah.
So we did a lot of shit ourselves, and we seemed to have success in a way that they couldn't really get their hands on, because maybe they didn't really know what we were going to do anyway, other than can you make this more successful? It's the only thing they could ever have said. And obviously we want that too. So it just didn't happen in the old fashioned way where it, you know, they come in and go, make your song shit and repeat this bit.
In a way, you were an early template for, I think, the way that even majors prefer it now, which is to take on a band, become fully formed. And they do a lot themselves, and they want to express, you know, when they have an album, it's got a theme, and they have got a brand, for want of a better word. And the job of a label then is actually just to try and get it to as many people as possible.
That's what our current label, exactly the model, it's called Artists Without a Label. That's the whole point of their existence, is that they realized that labels invariably get in the way of artists. So they're literally just there to fund and promote us. That's what they do, and they're perfectly happy to say that. And artists fucking love it. Obviously, some artists probably wouldn't love it because they rely on a support network of creatives to do their thing. We're just not like that. We like doing everything ourselves, and our fans like us doing everything ourselves. And the label we're on, AWOL, are perfectly happy for us, you know, to do that. Yeah. And it just works. And they're so old-fashioned, some of the majors, with all the ways they basically just try and get in the way of the artists. And I wouldn't say that ever really happened to us, but the transparency issue of, you know, where does the money go? That's the weird stuff that we never really understood, and that does still go on. But I think, it's becoming the model that we're currently involved with is becoming the norm, because it actually makes sense.
Kind of gives you inspiration for some of your creative material, in a sense, doesn't it? The impact of corporations on our lives as we're trying to sort of muddle through. That's definitely one of your themes. And I think, you know, that's present in the music industry as much as anything else, because tech has become such a big part of it.
I think audiences always know when, you know, when a unique voice, shall we say, appears on the scene, be it in TV, film, music, anything, when there's a fully formed band that already have their own brand, their own look and sound and ideas, or when that's a director, or when that's anything, that's the gold dust that everyone wants. Labels want it, audiences want it. And I don't think the old way of labels trying to create something out of something that isn't really there, that doesn't work anymore. And I think people know it. There's such an unbelievable amount of choice. It's really obvious, I think, when there's a pre-made product, apart from maybe to the youngest, who maybe don't see it as cynically as we do. Everyone knows when something has been created. And the way they got around that to begin with was to create it in front of everybody. So they would do your X Factors and say, this is the process. We've got somebody. Who do you like the most out of these lot? That one. Okay, we'll take him on to the next round. Who do you like now? That one. Okay. So by the end of the process, they were fucking guaranteed to be successful because we already democratically said, this is the one we're going to go with, because they've got the sob story and the looks and the voice, you know. And it was so brilliant, actually, to just go, you know what, we're just going to show you what, how we do this. And it guaranteed success for a while. I don't think that works anymore, though.
Yeah, I think it's definitely one of the secrets of longevity, though, is how you start, because you kind of create that culture around you from the early beginnings. And then actually, you know, it's the commerce does follow via whatever route. So, you know, via signing to a label or DIY, which I guess you were then, because you started off Infinity Industries as your label and then went with AWOL. But hang on a minute, AWOL's been bought by Sony Music, but at least you're back in the family.
We're back on Sony. I know. We realize how ridiculous that is. But we didn't leave Sony because we didn't like them. We just felt like a different, you know, way of doing things. It was very similar, to be honest. We just had fewer concerns. We just got left to our own devices. We got a similar, you know, deal, really. A better deal, actually, in terms of finance and stuff like that. And then more freedom. So it just made sense. And the fact that we're back on Sony is just kind of, sure, why not?
I mean, I was thinking about, you know, when we talked about your audiences, the fact that you kind of crossed that Rubicon, you know, you've had 2 Mercury nominations and 4 top 5 albums, you know, so you're kind of up there. You've done that without really ever relying on hit singles as such. What do those industry accolades, if you like, mean to you? Do they mean anything, or is it about really just connecting with the audiences, and how do you do that?
Yeah, it definitely means something to me, definitely. I'm immensely proud of our Mercury nominations. I think it's really one of the only ways we can say to people, you know, we are real, we are established, we are respected, because no one knows how many people are listening to X, Y, Z, that. No one knows what the capacity crowd is. No one knows what your Spotify metrics are, really. And they don't give a fuck anyway, because I don't care about that. When I listen to Arcade Fire, I don't actually care about how many other people are listening to it. You can't just go around saying, we've got so many listeners. We were on TV once. We were on the radio once. But you can say we were nominated twice, which is is great.
Yeah,
I love it. Obviously, I'd rather have a fan base than a Mercury nomination, and I'm lucky enough to have both. And it doesn't mean anything when it comes down to making a connection with people. I've seen some terrible things nominated for Mercuries before. You know, I would consider to be shit. So it's not actually a stamp of success or quality, but I like the fact that we have been nominated twice. Yeah, of course it did. And I want to get nominated again.
It's interesting hearing you explain that, because in a way I think that's maybe where the industry hasn't quite figured out the relationship between the old and the new. Being in the charts or being nominated for award is often kind of then attached to, hey, this is going to bring you commercial success. But actually, it means something creatively, or to be judged, you know, doing something that is a creative success among your peers, not necessarily because it's going to get you an audience, because that audience is kind of there. And it's funny, I work with a lot of young bands that are trying to assess their success, if you like.
Yeah,
and it's actually really hard. The more data you have, the harder it is.
Yeah, we do it all the time. We have a meeting scheduled for tomorrow morning, which is a sort of grand strategy one. We haven't really had a sit-down meeting with our manager since before the pandemic. And the main topic of conversation is basically, like, how are we doing as a band? We don't really know. We just got a top 4 album, but we feel like we're invisible. And yet, here you are saying it's the album of the year for you. You know, it's really hard to tell. Our Spotify listeners are doing great, but we're not being played on the radio. Like, where are we? Who are we? It's really difficult to tell. Yeah.
That's quite disorientating, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, how does that feel 15 years on from when you formed? Because I guess that landscape has changed.
You could tell exactly how big you were, because the only metric you had was radio and awards, frankly, and press. And we've never really had good press. I mean, we never had bad press, but we've never had much press. So we've never used that to determine anything. Yeah, we're just not an interesting band for press for some reason.
All right. Well, look, I know we don't have too long left. So I feel like you've made a masterpiece. But as I said, you know, one of the rules of longevity, if you like, is this belief that your best work is ahead of you. So where do you go from here? What are the next steps, both practically and in terms of what you're thinking for everything now?
Right now, we're talking about how to extend this campaign because we've done our tour and yet the album's only really impacting now, I would say. People are really listening to it now, and we've got this disjointed campaign where we've already done the tour and stuff like that. So we're going to talk about that. And really, I guess we're talking about touring next year and what, well, if we have to make more music, then I guess we will. I don't feel over the moon about that, but then I didn't for this album either. It was a surprise and it was a rush, to be honest. And maybe that's good for us. So all bets are off, to be honest. I don't feel like we need to make an album. I feel like we've just made a really fucking good one. I'd like to enjoy that more and I'd like to tour that more. And I'd actually like to make a film.
So have you got an idea in mind for a film?
No, but it would be a horror. I have lots of visual ideas, but I wouldn't say it's a narrative. And anyway, I'm making it with animation probably if I do it at all. And it will take a hell of a long time because it's only me and I don't really know what I'm doing, which is how I like it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah, animation does take a while, but okay. Jonathan, it's been fantastic to talk to you. Again, good luck with whatever you decide to do next. And as I say, really congratulations on a fantastic record.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
See you soon.
Nice one. See you later.